Welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Dellingpole. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but before we meet him, let's have a word from one of our sponsors.
Global warming is a massive con. There was no evidence whatsoever that man-made climate change is a problem, that it's going to kill us, that we need to amend our lifestyle in order to deal with it. It's a non-existent problem. But how do you explain this stuff to your normie friends? Well, I've just brought out the revised edition, my 2012 classic book, Watermelons, which captures the story of how some really nasty people decided to invent the global warming scare in order to fleece you, to take away your freedoms, to take away your land. It's a shocking story. I wrote it, as I say, in 2011 actually, the first edition came out. And it's a snapshot of a particular era. The era when the people behind the climate change scam got caught red-handed, tinkering with the data, torturing till it screamed, in a scandal that I helped christen ClimateGate. So I give you the background to the skullduggery that went on in these seats of learning where these supposed experts were informing us, we've got to act now. I rumbled their scam. I then asked the question, okay, if it is a scam, who's doing this and why? It's a good story. I've kept the original book pretty much as is, but I've written two new chapters, one at the beginning and one at the end, explaining how it's even worse than we thought. I think it still stands up. I think it's a good read. Obviously I'm biased, but I'd recommend it. You can buy it from jamesdellingpole.co.uk/shop. You'll probably find that one. Just go to my website and look for it, jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And I hope it helps keep you informed and gives you the material you need to bring round all those people who are still persuaded that, oh, it's a disaster, we must amend our ways and appease the gods, appease Mother Gaia. No, we don't. It's a scam.
Welcome to the Delling Pod, Richard Grove, forensic historian. You come highly recommended by Peter Duke. You must know who I mean.
Peter Duke, the guy with the wonderful green shirt, the linen, that he should have ironed a collar. I loved it as well.
That's really interesting that you liked the green of his shirt as well.
I know that. I mean, colors, certain colors go together, and that type of green really pops with like a nice Oxford twill, like Oxford shirt, yeah. Blue, right? If you had a green jacket like that, linen, that'd be rocking. But he's in California. He's rebuilding his wardrobe. Hats off to, I'll take a hat off, Peter. But for everyone else, I keep my hat on today.
Right.
Yeah, I've admired his work for a long time. He's a very smart guy. He recommended me. That's amazing.
So where are you? Not in California.
I'm outside of Hartford, Connecticut. So it's for translating, about an hour and a half north of New York City.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know anything about Connecticut apart from, didn't Mark Twain set one of his books there?
Mark Twain's house is in Hartford. There's the Mark Twain house, Samuel Clemens, a very famous American writer. Connecticut in British history would be famous for our first spy, Nathan Hale, 21-year-old school teacher from Coventry, Connecticut, was assigned by George Washington. Well, actually, he volunteered. But we Americans needed spies to go into New York City and gather British troop movements and how many ships. And this kid volunteered. He was part of Knowlton's Rangers, which is copied off of Rogers Rangers, right? So anyway, he gets captured by Robert Rogers of Rogers Rangers, and he's hung within 24 hours. And allegedly, he's attributed to saying, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country, which comes from Tullius Cicero.
Okay. Well, we may as well start with the Revolutionary War or the War of Independence, because one of the things I've noticed in my journey down the rabbit hole is that everything I've been taught about history, well, all conventional history, is a complete lie. It's the official narrative that they, the people who run the world, and I guess we're going to talk about them, that they want you to believe. So I'm assuming that everything we're told about the War of Independence, the Revolutionary War, is a complete lie.
Well, I mean, it's hard to discern, right? Because we weren't there and there's only certain artifacts left. So there's a story in America about the Boston Massacre, and there's a famous newspaper with the coffins printed on the cover of like the front page of the newspaper. And there is some incendiary rhetoric, right? So I can recognize colonist propaganda. I can recognize empire propaganda. Did the colonists throw snowballs in the redcoats, the regulars, fire upon the citizens? Like, who knows? These are stories. And if you're in America, you believe the people in the coffins were in the right and the regulars were wrong. And if you put yourself in the coat of a regular standing there, getting stuff thrown at you and stuff like that, and somebody yells fire, you might fire. Now, I would say a British regular should be knowledgeable and experienced enough that they would only listen to their commander saying fire and not a random person in the street. Allegedly, there was a fire that broke out. And when someone said fire, you know, these are like five different stories of the same thing. So my point is, you kind of need to be educated on all the perspectives to be able to make an informed decision. And then I ask myself, do I need to make a judgment on the situation, or do I just need to be knowledgeable? What benefit is it for me to take one side of that argument without having the evidence to argue against the other side? So I can see many sides of that situation. I can identify with an empire who was losing its colonies, and I can identify with colonists who didn't want to be ruled from across the sea.
Yeah, yeah. But that kind of debate could take place very comfortably within the conventional history narrative. I mean, you could have British and American historians who get published talking about this stuff, and they'd agree. How do we know? Every side's got its own version. I meant something deeper than that. It seems to me, and presumably you're going to tell me about this, about the way that Anglo-American elites, the kind of the Anglo-American deep state, conspired and continues to conspire to run the world. So there must have been, at the highest levels, there must have been some, the elites in both George III's Britain and colonial America, they must have been in cahoots on some level.
Well, that's a good point. Would you like to know a little bit about that?
Yeah.
All right. So the cahoots, I would trace it from British incursions into India, discovering the caste system, and then that caste system being put on like a piece of clothing by certain elements of the empire, including people in the colonies, the Boston Brahmins, I would bring up. Am I able to put my history blueprint on screen, James? Is that all right with you?
If you know how to do it, you do.
Boom. All right. Ooh. So if I were to go to, I would just type in Boston Brahmin, and I would get, if I spell it right. There we go. Boston Brahmins. First families of Boston. So these first families of Boston are primarily the movers and shakers in the colonies that some of them were loyalists. So a lot of these people, they end up being loyalists in a revolution that they lost, but they continue to operate behind the scenes because they have East India Company opium money going through. Right. So that's the power structure behind a lot of these families. You have the Forbes family, like John Forbes Kerry, who ran for president, the Skull and Bones guy. His family was a famous opium shipping, smuggling type of family. It goes back to the 1832 when East India Company privatized opium in 1832, which is why the East India Company College in America, Yale, founded by Elihu Yale, the East India Company, brought some of these things and kept them as part of the empire. The East India Company's records are kept at Yale. They're not kept over at your place. So
okay.
These families, the Delanos, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah.
The Delano family, the Roosevelt family. There's a list. I mean, this is official history. So the Forbes family, the Delano family, the Cabot family, Ben Bradley of the Washington Post. You ever hear him? He was a very famous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So he comes from the Cronenshield family of the Boston Brahmins. So when you look at the people in power and you see what did the generations before them do? Like as an example, Allen and John Foster Dulles in America had a lot of political, military, and supranational sway, funding the Nazis and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They had like three uncles who had already run the country as secretaries of state, Robert Lansing and other people in their family. So by the time they're brought up, they're coming from a family that commandeers America after our Civil War. And so these Boston Brahmin families, with the continuance of opium money coming into America at these very high levels, this is, they have some of the most remarkable mansions in Rhode Island from this trading sect, right? So Rhode Island all the way up through Boston, very wealthy families that participated in the opium trade. They called it the Old China Trade is the official term. If you want to look up such history, right. You'll see it's also the origin of free trade. Free trade by force into China with the opium to get the gold and silver back to Europe, because the Chinese wouldn't trade for the goods of Europe until somebody came along and figured out a way to subjugate them and bring it back. So there's go ahead.
So I can understand that the opium trade was very lucrative, but 1832 is quite late in US British history. So where was the money? When did the opium trade start, and what were these people doing before the opium trade? I mean, were they all impoverished, or did they suddenly, you know?
Well, a lot of them were in other types of shipping, and then they just switched over to the most profitable type of shipping. Some of them were in whaling and collecting whaling oil. And if you got to sail all the way around to the Pacific Ocean to get that, then you might as well maybe bring some other stuff back. So there are cargo loads in the early 1800s, like 1805. There's a guy who's from the Cabot family. So this is after we've won our independence from Britain, but these families are still provably participating in this trade. Cabot had like 20 tons of opium. And what they did was they would go over and trade furs. So the Astor family, Waldorf Astoria, they're a famous fur family. But you have to ask the question, to whom were they selling the furs, and to what were they trading for? And you start to get into the shipping manifest. There's fascinating history because you can see it in their own writing. A lot of these things are preserved in museums and studied over by people in like white cloth gloves, and they're showing you and taking you through. So there's a lot of interesting history on this. And it goes back to answer your question, like the early 1600s, 1601, I think, East India Company under Queen Elizabeth I, they start figuring out some of the spice trade, right? And some of the penchants that they pick up are for this opium from the Far East. Now, you said 1832 is late in the game, but it's early in the game for like the expansion of empire and the first, second opium wars and the first, second, third Anglo-Afghan wars and all these other things in those areas over there. But if you want to go back to 1776 or 1773 to 1776, there were a lot of various activities in America. There's a Boston Tea Party where people sort of had an uprising because they put a 2% tax on their favorite breakfast beverage. But it's an interesting situation because it's a false flag attack, because they dressed as Native Americans to scare the regulars. They organized at the Green Dragon Tavern, which was a Freemason tavern. So there's a whole lot of interesting kind of mythology that goes with that whole situation. But really, it comes down to, you guys didn't have enough British regulars to suppress the colonies, and you brought in Hessian soldiers. And it was a good technique because they're very scary guys. They don't speak English. They're very, you know, German's kind of like a rough, angry language sometimes. And so it scared the colonists for a while. And all these Hessian soldiers being used over here cost a lot of money. So in order to rent the Hessian soldiers, George III was sending money to his cousin, not Von Knigge, he's in the Illuminati. It's these guys, it's William of Hessa. So it's Wilhelm until he becomes William. So he's got a complicated name because it's German and it's not, and he's like a landgrave instead of a prince or an earl or something that's more Englishy, right? So it's a cousin of George III, and he's sending a whole bunch of money over there for these soldiers to come over to America to suppress the colonists. Well, it's that funding right there that allows a rare coin trader, Meyer Amschel Rothschild, to start to build wealth and to start build relationship with not only the guy who was renting the soldiers, but his son who inherits all that money. So by the time you get right after the American war, you know, it ends in 1789. So just within like 10, 15 years after that, Napoleon rises. And it's because Napoleon rises that William has to hide his money. So he gives it to Amschel Rothschild to send over to his son, Nathan, in London, who had just opened a banking house. And then Nathan invests that in the East India Company, later gives it back to Britain in 1812, later uses it to save the Bank of England, to buy the Royal Mint, and a whole ride to tyranny after that. But my point in that origin story is, if you guys hadn't used the Hessians, this other thing wouldn't have been so empowered. So I don't blame you, because you and I weren't, we just got here. When were you
born?
Yeah, we
didn't know. I agree.
How close are we? How close are we, James? What's your birth year?
My birth year, 65.
Oh, right on, dude. I thought we were the same age. I'm 73.
No, you're a child. I'm an old man. long maybe.
I will soon be there. It's a fast ride.
So, I find all that stuff very, very interesting, and I want to learn more about. This
am I not bit. Answering your question as specifically? Give me the detail you're looking for.
No. I like to meander. I suppose I'm particularly interested in where it all started, because it seems to me that okay, I said 1832 seems quite late. Even the 1776 seems too late. I'm interested in what the real deal was. You know how in upper class American circles, the really smart families, the Cabots, for example, can trace their origins back to the families that came over with the Mayflower or whatever.
Of course.
So this stuff, this Brahmin thing, even though it didn't have a name at that time, must have been going on even earlier than the War of Independence. So what I'm curious about is, because it can't have been just a bunch of Puritan. The story about how a bunch of dissenters were sort of fled oppressive Britain to set up these new colonies in America. I mean, okay, that's obviously the cover story, but I can't imagine people who became that powerful were just women in black clothes with white bonnets and stern men who had a particularly kind of austere form of Protestantism. There must have been something else going on under the hood.
Well, I think that what you might be pointing to is the massive land grants that were made to people who served the king, and he'd be like, oh, here's Virginia. Here's, you know, a whole section of Ohio.
Yeah.
So there's that. It's not the Puritans who like populated this place. They were just people who like, I don't know, somebody had to break through with the Indians, I guess. The French did a much better job. The French actually intermarried, you know, all the French traders and explorers, they were much more symbiotic, let's say, you know, and I think it was when there's a note from the king and the Hudson Bay Company's like, this is the king's land, that, you know, things really got in conflict. But you're also talking about an empire that knows expertly how to profit from such conflicts, how to exploit such conflicts. I mean, you guys have a lot of history over there that we Americans never really get a glimpse at in our teaching, at least in this century, because our textbooks were changed in the 1920s to reflect a different attitude about things.
But I'm just thinking. Yeah, okay, it amazes me that the French didn't do better, given that Louis would have been Louis XIV at the time. I mean, in the 17th century, it would have been Louis the 14th, who was no slouch when it came to kind of
But they would have done better if Napoleon wasn't rocking over there. I don't think we would have had the Louisiana Purchase. I'm pretty sure France sold us that big piece of land to Thomas Jefferson because Napoleon, like, there was something else going on and they needed to raise money real quick.
No, I'm talking about the 17th century, okay. Not the late 18th century, which is when Napoleon appeared on the scene. So we've got that early period. It just seems to me to be quite murky. And surely not as it's been sold to us, because we know that the world is run by these secretive elites, and that the history we're told is just a cover for that. So I'm wondering, people must have realized in Europe that America was going to be a thing one day, so they must have got their claws in to these colonies quite early on. And I'm just wondering is it the same families that later on became opium traders, is what I'm asking.
Well, I don't know about that, but they're probably the same families that participated in various slave trades prior to finding opium so lucrative, because human capital was a very popular thing back then. America was being exploited over here by the Spanish, by the French, by the British, by privateers, by pirates. There's a whole bunch of things that went on. Now, Manhattan, as an example, was the 1600s when that purchase is made for $24. Back in the day. And those gentlemen were from Amsterdam. And the gentlemen from Amsterdam, I think, if you follow the history back, are the remnants of people who fled Spain in 1492. A lot of them went to Amsterdam. And some of those people came over here and bought property and developed in New York City before the British took it from the Dutch.
Right.
That's my recollection. That's not my speciality in history, but that's my understanding.
Okay. Do you think that these folk really were a sort of breakaway movement from old Europe, or do you think underneath they were the same class of people?
Well, I think the usual trend is they use poor people to break ground and go do all the hard work, and then they come in and exploit it later. So an American miniseries that would depict a situation like that is called Deadwood. It's about this town in the Dakotas. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's run by corruption. And you think all these people are so corrupt. And then once they get everything nice, they get the railroad coming and they got all the stuff. These guys come along and they're like, we just made this a state and we're in control. So then you find out that government's the biggest gangsters of all in that situation. And that, yes, they had given land for free to get suckers to move out there, to give their lives, to dig the stuff. And when it's built, these people will come take it.
Yeah.
So it's throughout history, like as a forensic historian looking at this entire span of human history, you can account for most things by people doing evil things to other people. And you don't have to get so supernatural on it. And the other thing is, I've only seen one war. It's the war against the people seeking to express consciousness, and it's waged by those who want to suppress consciousness. And so when you look at that, there's always in the past several hundred years, this veil of government between the people who will use extreme violence to subjugate people for power.
Yeah.
So it's more That's power. It's like more attractive than money. Money is something that gets people to that power, but money's not the thing. It's just them wanting power. Absolute
I think
power
you're
corrupts,
right.
Absolutely, said your Lord Acton.
Yeah, I think that it is ultimately the follow the money argument only gets you so far. It is these
it gets you to
the
people
money
that print
world.
Money out of nothing. Like, what did the Templars come back from the Middle East when they went on those crusades and they came back and all of a sudden they become rich and powerful? Did they discover what? Fractional reserve lending? Like, what did they discover? Some sort of banking maneuver. And then you can trace that back to these things weren't possible until the Venetian bankers changed us from Roman numerals to Arabic numerals, because then you could do all these other things with the numbers that you couldn't do with the Roman numerals.
A quick word from our sponsor.
Sina Crisp. I used to eat loads and loads of crisps in my normie days. And then, of course, I discovered that they're all cooked in toxic seed oils. And so I pretty much gave up. The people behind Sina have come up with a brilliant idea of cooking crisps not in seed oils, but in coconut oil. So they're actually not harmful to you. And they also taste Good. Was that a good idea to eat my crisps in the middle of the advert? I'm not sure. Anyway, I just want to make something absolutely clear. Just because I'm starting to do crisp adverts doesn't mean I'm about to become the new Gary Lineker. That's a joke that will go completely over the head of non-British viewers, and I envy those who don't know who Gary Lineker is. They're organic, they are not ultra-processed food, no seed oils, and you can find them at www.sinacrisps, that's S for sugar, I-N-A, crisps.com.
Use the code James for 15% off your order.
So, again, I'm not Gary Lineker, and I envy those of you who don't know who Gary Lineker is. I'm advertising crisps, but they are good crisps. They taste good, and they're cooked in coconut oil. So check out Sina Crisps.
Use the code James, J-A-M-E-S, that's me, for 15% off your order.
Now, back to the Delling Pod.
Roman numerals to Arabic numerals, because then you could do all these other things with the numbers that you couldn't do with the Roman numerals. And I mean, I like Arabic numerals. I'm fan of them. Math's real easy with them. But like, there are these things that have evolved over a longer span of history. One of the most interesting books on the history of how money has been used in human history, so you can really get a good definition of it, over 600 pages. I think it's 24 use cases of money throughout history. The Lost Science of Money by Stephen Zarlinga, who also published one of Carol Quigley's books once upon a time. I think it was Evolution of Civilizations.
I hadn't heard the one about the transition from Roman numerals to Arabic numerals. So it enabled them to get to practice the dodgy accounting that enabled them to get even richer.
It's when you actually get into like learning about the history of such things, it's so much more fantastic and interesting and like curiosity inspiring than what they've told us. It's so much more rich in detail and texture. So yeah, there's a long history, and you can actually change. You could track, like, there's banking technology, right? So you could track it from like Phoenicia into Carthage, and then when it goes and jumps over into Rome, it like erases its tracks as it moves, and it moves throughout different countries throughout history. It's fascinating. Truly fascinating.
Tell me about Phoenicia.
Well, Phoenicia was thousands of years ago, was a group of people that lived on a coast of what is Palestine, Israel area today. Phoenicia Canaan was how it was known. And they were masters of maritime trade. So they had more sophisticated technology to navigate, and they were able to, you know, inject commerce and connect various areas. And they were a very powerful ruling force that eventually, once it goes from Phoenicia into Carthage, into Rome, up to Venice, and then it moves into Europe, and then it moves over into Great Britain. City of London. So the City of London technology would come from, you know, you've got Fugger history. You got a whole bunch of various pieces of history of money, money changing, money lending, court factors throughout Europe. And I mean, that being court factor was the origin of the Rothschild dynasty.
Before we go on, tell me how you became a forensic historian. Well, what is a forensic historian?
It's someone who identifies pieces of history that exist outside of the narratives that help you actually understand the truth that can't be contained in those cartoonish or caricaturized narratives. So in my case, I was looking at how the world worked, and I was reading a book called The House of Morgan by Ron Chernow. Now, this is a...
I've read his biography of... He does epic biographies. I read his...
Epic biographies of Robert Barron type people, right? Like, he's... Ron Chernow is America's Neil Ferguson.
Is he?
And I'm not talking about the COVID Neil Ferguson who had the sex.
He's very establishment.
Yes, very. So I'm reading the very establishment book. I didn't know about other types of books yet, right? So I was like, I'm reading about the House of Morgan, and I was... That day that I was reading this page that I'm going to tell you about, I had just testified in court pro se, and I was suing a multi-billion-dollar company whose finance or whose founder was Cheney's biggest fundraiser, and he was ambassador to Ireland at the time. I didn't know these things when I sued my employer. You pull on the tail of the line and you find out what it's connected. I didn't know it was a tail. Anyway, so I'm in court. I just testified. The lawyers I'm up against are, I'm representing myself against a multi-billion dollar company. There's the biggest lawyers in the world, Skadden, Arps, Marr, and Flom, defending EMC Company, which is now Dell EMC. So I'm in this book, House of Morgan, and on the bottom of a right-hand page, it says, it was at this point that J.P. Morgan's white glove law firm, Davis, Polk, and Wardell, refused to do these kind of extreme hostile takeovers, and they had to go find a new dirty law firm, Skadden, Arps, Marr, and Flom, which would do these types of things. And I'm like, oh my God, dude, these are the guys I'm up against. So then I'm like, well, who are these people? Oh, they defend, like, when the Kuwaitis needed their gold back from Saddam. Wait, that wasn't Skadden, Arps. Yeah, Skadden did have something to do with that, but so did Kroll Associates. So then there start to be overlaps between agencies that I saw in reality, and now I'm looking into beyond Ron Chernow. So it was a couple years earlier, so that was 2006-ish. 2004, I had learned about a book called Tragedy and Hope. Now, James, I had never been a conspiracy. I didn't know anything about anything, right? The best I had angle on I might not know everything was a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me. I bought it at Barnes & Noble. I was like, oh, I'm going to get smart reading this book. So I didn't know much when I heard about this book, and I heard about it in a video presentation. I bought a bunch of DVDs off of eBay. So it was like 50 research movies on various things, right? So the documentary was called The Brotherhood of Darkness. And it was filmed at this Christian churchy type place in the middle of America, like Oklahoma or someplace. And it was called the Prophecy Club. And so the Prophecy Club, they have this guy, Stan Monteith, and he's telling this story. And I don't know who Stan Monteith is. I found out later he's a dentist. I found out later he bootlegged Tragedy and Hope, the book he talks about in this presentation. So he starts talking about this poem, and it's like a British poet, and he's reading it. I'm like, okay, I don't get it, because I'm an American, but he seems very into it. So he's very passionate, and I keep listening. And then he gets to this part about Cecil Rhodes. And I had no idea who Cecil Rhodes was, but I did know what De Beers was. I know that's the Diamond People, right? Yeah. So I'm listening to this whole story, and he tells you about Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Carol Quigley, published in 1966, that was then had the printing plates destroyed and was censored so no one could see it. And so I had to, after this presentation, I was so incredulous. I was like, this guy is so full of shit. I got to disprove it, right? So I went and I invested $300 to get a used copy, a beat up library copy of Tragedy and Hope. And I start, oh, page 52, here's the Rothschild family. I worked on Wall Street. No one ever talked about the Rothschild family. This is not even a thing on my radar. I have a college degree. If they existed, I would know about it. James, I read the Wall Street Journal. I read Barron's. I read Congressional Quarterly, The Economist. There's no mention of the Rothschilds anyplace. Like, so
even
to me,
the Rothschilds own The Economist.
Right, exactly. And Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call, all those official magazines like the government people would use, like that's what your congressmen and senators read. So I read. It's a very long, dry book, but there's a couple places in there he hit some stuff. And when he started laying out in the beginning, like pages 52, 53, 54, like how some of this stuff works, and then he goes back to it on page like 960 and page whatever, 1100, there's a substantial amount of that story that makes sense, that lines up to reality, that I have found artifacts to confirm, that is way outside of our official knowledge of such things. So he talks about Lord Montague Norman of the Bank of England and Helmar Horace Greeley Schacht from Brooklyn, who is Hitler's banker. and how they worked together to create the Bank for International Settlements in 1931, and then all this other stuff that follows. And so I didn't believe Quigley. So I didn't believe Monteith, and I don't believe Quigley. But I'm holding space. I'm looking at this stuff. Then I discover Anthony Sutton's work. And who is he? He worked for the Hoover Institute for World Peace, and he gets fired by a trilateral guy after he looks into trilaterals. And then he had written the Wall Street, Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street, FDR, Wall Street, and Hitler. And then you read those books and his Federal Reserve conspiracy. He wrote like 10 or 15 books. So you start comparing these things, but they're still just stories. And then you say, what evidence exists? So I invested in a first edition copy of The Private Papers of Colonel Edward Mandel House by Charles Seymour of Yale University. And these are fascinating books. And my first edition, some of the pages aren't even cut because of how they used to make books with folded pages. So there's pages in there I've had to like slice open just to read it. So I got that set of books. That was interesting. Then I got Lord Grey's personal papers. He's the guy on the other side of the ocean writing back and forth with Colonel House about how they're going to make World War II happen, or World War I, sorry. Mm-hmm. World War I. This is like 1916, 1917. So that's pretty interesting. And then at one point, after hearing the story of Cecil Rhodes, I was like, well, who is this guy, William T. Stead? Because he's the co-conspirator of Rhodes. He died in the Titanic. There is a monument to William T. Stead in Central Park, New York City. Interesting. William T. Stead, by the way, did the first interview. He invented the thing we're doing right now. 1886, he interviewed a guy called General Gordon, who was over there in India doing some work for the king or queen. I forget who it was, probably Queen Victoria. And it's around this time that the Anglo-American establishment starts to kind of like congeal. Now, there's already meetings in the 1870s and 80s at Jekyll Island, America, off the coast of Georgia, where they made the Federal Reserve later. That had been a robber baron hangout. It was like the recipient of the first transatlantic call. They routed it down to these guys on this island so they could talk back and forth. Conan Doyle at a Pilgrim Society meeting, according to the history of the Pilgrim Society by Edward Piazzi, I think is the author. In there, it talks about how Conan Doyle came up with the idea to bring America back into the empire. Ruskin also had this idea that he kind of dropped down the Rhodes. The Freemasons that Rhodes was part of wanted some domination. The British Empire that Rhodes was part of and colonizing for wanted some domination. And the Rothschilds, who funded Rhodes and created his scholarships, also wanted some things. So these forces, Anglo-American establishment, and it would have overlap with the British Israel World Federation movement of that time, starts to say these things. Andrew Carnegie has some things to say in the late 1890s about bringing America into the empire. And Rhodes's will says he would like to use his wealth, because he's not having kids, he doesn't have a family, he'd like to use his wealth to create a secret society for the purposes of bringing America back into the empire so they could take over the world. And then he goes into detail about how it's going to be done. And part of that is going to be the Rhodes Scholarships. But he dies in 1902, and the Rothschilds come in and they say, we want to create these Rhodes Scholarships. We're going to fund it because, you know, we helped him achieve these endeavors, and we're going to help them use them for the rest of the 20th century, because now this Anglo-American establishment is in position. It comes over to America in 1902 in the form of the New York side of the Pilgrim Society. Now you've got people from, they came over here with the Pilgrims. You got the ruling elite of America codified into this group. And then as the 1900s start going forward, immediately in 1902, they create the General Education Board to change education into schooling, because they need obedient workers, because they're going to make a war economy. And we're going to have to. So the Carnegie Foundation in 1908 starts saying, if we want to take over the political machine, first question they asked was, is there any other mechanism other than war to change population rapidly? And they came back with the answer, like, no, war is the most effective way to change over a society. And then they asked the question, how can we keep America at war? And there's all these questions. This is coming from whistleblower Norman Dodd during the Reese Committee in the 1950s, proving that these nonprofit foundations created by the robber baron class of the Anglo-American establishment were conducting un-American activities, changing the attitudes, values, behaviors, and beliefs of Americans to be more in line, to be merged with international communism, which is the New World Order's operating system for no nation states.
Yeah. Sorry, I was...
So I could go a variety of ways from there, but did you have a question in anything I said? Because I would like to substantiate.
No. You were telling me about your journey to becoming a forensic historian.
So to answer the question, I was leading up to an artifact.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what this is? Have you seen it?
The Filofax.
It's a Filofax, exactly. No, it's not. This is a book in bubble wrap. I'll put my spectacles on so as not to abuse the listening folks of this Delling pod.
Oh, okay.
This is William T. Stead's copy of such book. It comes from the Review of Reviews Library, which he was the owner of. And this is a first edition. This is Cecil Rhodes. Review of Reviews. And it's edited by William T. Stead, who's the co-conspirator. So in here, there's a lot of things in here, but it's a fragile book. You can see in Rhodes' own handwriting, but that's not the part we're going to look at. We're going to look at some of these highlighted parts about the secret society. Here, I'll just zoom in for you. What an awful thought it is that if we had not lost America, or if even now we could arrange with the present members of the United States Assembly in our House of Commons, the peace of the world is secured for all eternity. We could hold your federal parliament 5 years at Washington and 5 at London. The only thing feasible to carry this out is a secret one, society, gradually absorbing the wealth of the world to be devoted to such an object. There is Hirsch with his 20 millions. Now, that's interesting because he's talking about a guy, Hirsch, and I have another book that talks about the financier Hirsch. And when you put these two ideas together, there's a lot of overlap, but that's not the artifact I'm sharing. So I'm going to stay on point here. So he wants to create a secret society for the purposes of bringing America back into Great Britain. And I wanted to see if there was one more highlighted section that was easily referenceable. I don't like to go through this book too much because it's falling apart and it is a valuable here. This is Stead. That was my idea as I expressed it. That was Mr. Rhodes' idea as well. It was our idea. His idea of the secret society broadened and made presentable to the public without in any way revealing the esoteric truth that lay behind. Mr. Rhodes recognized this and eagerly welcomed it. So then it talks about a whole bunch of other stuff. But the point is, there's an artifact. It proves that there was an agenda. And then when you look at the actions of the agenda afterwards, you see the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations as an agency that helps to take this will, and it's participatory by the people who were in Rhodes's, they call it Milner's Kindergarten, but it's all the Rhodes people. Lord Milner, Lord Grey, Lionel Curtis. Lionel Curtis, I believe, is the one that Carol Quigley, do you know about the Quigley tape from 1976?
Tell me.
Okay, so Quigley wrote Tragedy and Hope in 1966. He is the Edmund A. Walsh Professor of Foreign Relations at Georgetown University. He was a teacher of Bill Clinton, who became a Rhodes Scholar but didn't finish because of his sexual proclivities. He got kicked out for some sexual assault types. Some people would say that automatically graduated him. But anyway, 66, he's writing the book. He spent 40 years writing it. After a whistleblower came to him in 1946 through 48. So a whistleblower from inside the secret society's roundtable movement came to Carol Quigley, told him this story. Quigley said, "This is too hot to trot. I'm going to write down the story, but I'm not going to publish it." He didn't publish it until after his death. So Anglo-American Establishment is the first book written in 1948, not published until 1981. It tells you the details of how it worked. He then spent 20 years going to the Council on Foreign Relations archives, writing Tragedy and Hope, hiding key parts of that in the story. So the people who published it, Macmillan Publishing, they put it on the street, it sells out, and then they tell Quigley there's no demand and there'll be no second printing of it. Now, what happened was Macmillan destroyed the plates of the book. came out, they took the first half of the book. It's a 1,300-page book. First half of the book, just delete it. It starts in the, just they just start at a page and they reprint the second half of the book. That book is called The World Since 1939, A History by Carol Quigley. That is a rare artifact, which I also do own. It's verbatim, just the second half of Tragedy and Hope. They don't want you to know how it started, which is interesting, right? So now it's like, what's in the first half of the book? Bank of International Settlements, Rothschilds, all this other network that they don't want you to know. They just want you to know the last piece. So then Quigley, he's being lied to by Macmillan. So he gets into it's a newspaper article by New York Times reporter Rudy Maxa, M-A-X-A. But Rudy made a recording of it. And in Columbia, in the stacks, as John Taylor Gatto said, there's a recording of Quigley talking to this guy. Well, one of my buddies, his name's Kevin Cole, Kevin went and got that recording, and then he wrote, like, it was called The Professor Who Knew Too Much. And he analyzes it. So here's what you could learn from such artifact. Quigley admits that Macmillan lied to him and that they destroyed the printing plates for the book so it could not be republished. They told him there was no demand for it. He explains to Rudy Maxa how there's a conspiracy going on just right there. At the end of the conversation, Rudy Maxa brings up the name Lionel Curtis. And Quigley is very uncomfortable and he says, turn off the tape. Like, turn off the tape if you want to keep your job, keep your life type of thing, right?
Yeah.
So that's where it ends. So then the question goes back, like, who's Lionel Curtis and why is everyone so worried about him? Even in 1976, I'm pretty sure Lionel Curtis is dead by then.
He sounds like Beyonce. Still,
what's that?
He sounds like Beyonce because everyone in Hollywood is and the entertainment industry is like, they're terrified of Beyonce. And in the same way, this guy Curtis sounds like a scary dude.
Now, I'm just going to flip real quick to see if I can find the name Hirsch, because that was the one that was left hanging there that I know I have the other reference for. Yes, I found it. Well, okay. I'm not going to say it's the same one from this reference, but I was able to find it. It's a reference to a plan to acquire land. This plan's from the 1860s, and it references Hirsch as one of the potential funders of this project. So when Rhodes is writing his will within 20 years of this book in the 1880s, I don't know if there's a different Hirsch who's a financier that would be so overlapping in the Venn diagram, but this book is by... It also mentions the Rothschild brothers as being funders of this project. This book is by the father of utopian socialism. It's very rare. It's hard to get. But it's from 1862. Moses has the revival of Israel, Rome and Jerusalem, the last nationalist question. So when you get into that, Hess, the utopian socialist, is a nationalist. Do you see a problem with a nationalist who's a socialist? This is the origin of an ideology well before the Tiny Mustache Man. And they create a plan to restore Jews to Palestine, taking over Freemasonic lodges in Europe and using them to merge all the historical cults into one. It is a fascinating 1862 little artifact right there. But when you put that and overlap it with another layer of the conspiracy, because these things all actually happened, you know, it wasn't, somebody might say it's propaganda that in 1829 in the Niles Weekly Register, that the report is that Lord Rothschild just purchased Jerusalem from the Ottoman Turks, from the Grand Poobah over there. And so there's this article, and I looked at it and I said, this is interesting because I don't know if it's true. It could be rumor, okay? But when there's a rumor article in 1829, a rumor article in 1833, a rumor article in 1835, and then a plan codified in 1862, and then another plan codified, and then they come up with Rothschild colonization of Palestine in the 1880s. Like, there's a whole series of events that walks them forward. I mean, you've got Lord Shaftesbury's 1841 proclamation to restore Jews to Palestine. So there's a whole, like, timeline of events that is very interesting and illustrative. And I, like I said, you don't have to make conclusions or jump to like rash judgments. just fill in the blanks of like, so you have, you're learning with the intent to understand what happened and what is relevant and substantial as opposed to what is arbitrary to be dismissed. So artifacts that exist, I think they have to be contended with. So these articles I was just referring to in the 1800s, are they predicting the future because they had a screen glass, a palantir, an oracle to see the future? I don't think so. I think they're just on to other people's business plans, and yeah, they may have not publicized it widely, although you can follow those reports into codified plans, into colonization, into the Balfour Declaration, into Germany being having war reparations that they can't pay, at the same time building huge roads in Palestine, and the British making a turnkey colonization effort that they turned over to the people that they gave the receipt to the Balfour Declaration to.
Okay. We can go anywhere on this because you've raised so many interesting points, but I just wanted to follow up too. Sorry, tell me the name of the guy again that people were scared to mention his name.
Lionel Curtis.
Well, tell me about him.
Well, Lionel Curtis was the second after Lord. So it went like Rhodes, Milner. Milner had his kindergarten. Lionel Curtis rises above that. So he is a mover and shaker in the teens, 20s, into the 30s, waning out maybe by the 1940s, at least in American culture, as far as I can recall. Now, he's a contemporary of another guy. There's Leo Amery and Alfred Zimmern. I'm pretty sure that Zimmern was the whistleblower for Quigley, but it may have been Leo Amery because it's been a long time since I read that book. Both of these guys are working in the sphere of a Lionel Curtis. So let me bring up, there's several Lionels in my model. You got some Lionel Rothschilds, you got Lionel Pincus, Lionel Curtis. Here you go. 1872 to 1955. He's the handler. He's the like the British side handler of Colonel House. And Colonel House is the handler of Woodrow Wilson. And there's also Samuel Untermeyer in between. So it went Wilson, House, Untermeyer, Curtis, Lord Grey, King. That was like the hierarchy and chain of command through reading private papers between these groups and understanding the American side and Colonel House's role as being like he's the kingmaker for Woodrow Wilson.
So he was the chief of staff of Woodrow Wilson?
Yeah, like, you know, first off, chiefs of staff are the notorious characters that everyone should follow in any position of power because they're the ones keeping the king's gloves clean, right? Chiefs of staff, those types of characters. Now, in this case, Colonel Edward Mandel House, he wrote a fictitious pseudonym book called Philip Drew Administrator, which Corbett has done a famous piece on 20 years ago. Philip Drew Administrator is kind of like, if I ran things, here's how I would run them.
Yeah.
Right. It's like this utopian government type thing. So House is a kingmaker over here. He comes from Beaumont, Texas. He's like Southern royalty. Okay. And this is after the Civil War. He's Southern royalty still after the Civil War. So Woody Wilson starts giving these campaign speeches in 1911. And I have a first edition published by London. They took great interest in his campaign speeches, apparently. So that's where the New Freedom first edition that I have comes from. Anyway, there was this, I got that book because there was a quote from Woodrow Wilson that I was trying to verify. And everyone on the internet's like, this is a specious quote. It's not factual, blah, 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 blah. Right. So there's many of these quotes. There's one actually about Philip Drew that is like that, that can't be verified. Right. So coming back to Wilson, I'm trying to verify this quote. So I got to get the book. Well, come to find out, the quote's 8 or 9 pages long, bro. So, of course, you're going to have to paraphrase it and like take pieces to tell people what's going on. And that's what happened on the internet. So the quote starts on like page 12 and it's like, since I have entered politics, men have chiefly confided their concerns to me. And there is a power so great, so overwhelming, so massive that the average person had not better speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it, a power that will prevent new men with new ideas from entering the marketplace. And you will be cut off from the marketplace and cut off from money and commerce. And there's this whole thing he says. And then like right after that, they make that dude president. Now, he was just some boring guy from Princeton University doing his thing. And they're like, we can make this guy into our guy. So they get him into office. They, you know, he gets reelected because he kept us out of the war, famously. And then he got us into the war, famously.
It's a bit
and
like Trump. Trump's the famous anti-war guy who was just like, he sold us his record. It was just great.
And Woodrow Wilson is regarded by many libertarian philosophers as the worst president in American history, but I'm pretty sure living through the Trump era, like, I don't know everything about Woodrow Wilson. He wasn't great, but what's going on right now is just blasphemous.
Yeah.
Even just as a human being, seeing what's going on and where our money's going and the fact that they're censoring just one side of the argument, and that's how genocide and ethnic cleansing can perpetuate itself throughout the world. There's a lot of things that go on like that. And, yeah, I think it's our job to say what we see.
So I don't want to interrupt you, but at the same time, I don't want to forget about this point. When you were reading the W.T. Stead stuff on on Rhodes,
yeah,
there's a bit he talks about the esoteric thing that this notion they all have, they're all agreed on, it's esoteric. Is that is that Freemasonry? Is that the occult? What's going on there?
Okay, excellent question. The way I would elucidate it was this. Rhodes is, one of his closest friends is Rudyard Kipling, also a Freemason, right? And if you're familiar with The Man Who Would Be King, I think it's that, like, Freemasonic mythical liturgy mixed in with the capability for colonization that the British Empire had built up, combined with the banking power. So the bankers needed military, the military needed some bankers, and they both decided they wanted some things, right? Let's take over the world. Let's get our own nation state with nuclear weapons. Let's make these other guys pay for it. You know, it's done deal.
Yeah. It's odd. When I first discovered about the Milner Group and the,
I mean, that's an oversimplification for purposes of brevity, but these are much bigger ideas that can be dug into. I don't expect anyone here to believe what I'm saying. I expect you to be incredulous and look it up like I did. That's education.
So the Milner Group and the Boer War leading up to the First World War, there clearly was a conspiracy of Anglo-American elites, but there's a side to Cecil Rhodes that you could almost, I mean, and this was the line that inspired a lot of young Englishmen to kind of support him and to share the ideals of the other guy you just mentioned,
Ruskin, John Ruskin,
exactly. That it was like we were going to. The Anglosphere, the English-speaking world was going to civilize everywhere. And, I mean, because we know what the consequences of this plan were, we can look at it now as kind of awful. But do you think there was anything noble about the plan? I mean,
we could discuss the nobility, but I want to notice the overlap, because what you're pointing out is like when America gets into the Spanish-American War, so it's Uncle Sam and John Bull, in the political cartoons back then, and they've got baskets of brown people on their back, and they're like, we're taking them up the mountain, right? So that's like, that's Kipling Freemasonry. That's like nation state symbols, right? Because Uncle Sam was new, but you guys had John Bull, so we needed an equal, right, in that situation. And that overlapped that America getting into not Americans' activities. That's empire building, starting with the Spanish-American War and a false flag. Most likely, remember the Maine, said Hearst, right? So that is going on at the same time. There's a changeover in American, like Anglo-American goals. It's no longer like they had already done Manifest Destiny and got to the sea. They're like, what do we do next? Take over the world. So it's like the next evolution of their goals. But you also had the Boer War going on at that same time with the invention of the concentration camp, and then Milner's men working this plan into, like, how do we take it global? And having a staff of people that would be on guard. Like, how many Rhodes scholars were in the German military in World War I and or World War II? Now, they stopped doing it during the wars. But my point is, they already had 18 years of putting some people in their infrastructure. And when you read, I got one for you. Where is he at? Knocked stuff over. All right, I have a book here by the guy who ran MI6 during World War II, John Cecil Masterman. And the British espionage and spycraft is so far above. I mean, I guess the French might have it, but I don't read French. So I'm just saying, you guys are really good at doing some things that, you know, started with East India Company, intelligence, insurance, and security, and then turned into intelligence agencies in the 20th century. So you guys had spies in Germany, you had spies in Japan, giving you all sorts of stuff. You guys knew about Pearl Harbor in August of 1941 because you had agents Garbo, Tricycle, I forget the other ones. But the point is, you guys had a good network of agents in these areas and knew what was up from the get-go. You had Room 40, where Churchill is like watching all the World War One German submarine Wolfpack activity and stuff like that. Signals intelligence, you guys pioneered. You guys were tapping telephone lines during the Civil War. America didn't learn how to do this stuff. And like, we didn't have a signals intelligence agency until 1952. GCHQ is 1901. It's 50 years superior when you guys are teaching us how to do this stuff. MI6 created OSS and CIA. So there's a huge...
I don't feel reassured by this, Richard, because I'm thinking, well, these guys are going to be spying on me.
We're all spied on, dude. When I interviewed Bill Binney, we went to dinner afterwards, and my wife said something like, are we going to be on a list now because we interviewed you? And he said, you were on the list before you interviewed me because you wanted to interview me. He's like...
An interview with who, sorry?
Former technical director of the National Security Agency, 2001 whistleblower William Binney, who told everybody about surveillance and spying like 10 years before Snowden.
He sounds good. Is he still alive?
Yeah. I have an interview with him on my YouTube page. It's my only video with 1 million+ views. And it's because of him, not me.
I hadn't even heard of him. He sounds really good. Is he a good talker?
He's an excellent talker. He's in a wheelchair. When the FBI or whoever raided him as a whistleblower, they harassed Thomas Drake. There's a whole bunch of whistleblowers they either put in prison or they harassed. When they raided Binney, he, as a man who's a paraplegic, doesn't have his prosthetics on. He's in the shower and they come and stick guns in his face. And he wasn't the least bit scared because he knows those people were cowards. He's like, oh, yeah, oh, you're getting the drop on me. You're getting the drop, you know? So, like, he's a calm, cool, collected guy, which is why when he started experiencing Havana syndrome a couple years ago and talking about it, they tried to make him look like he's wacky, which is why they probably targeted him with Havana syndrome, because someone in his position knows too much, and yet he's probably got a dead man switch, so he keeps rolling around.
Right.
He's a very interesting guy, very high aptitude guy. And I talked with him. I took that Masterman MI6 book with me to dinner. And we talked heavily about, because I wanted him to know. I'm like, dude, do you know what, like, you know, the history of this is? And, you know, you have to have respect. I have respect for all those agencies that know more than the, you know, MI6 comes out of East India. Like, if you trace the first directors of MI6, it goes back to like De Beers and East India Company opium people. Mm. So then you can see, okay, so this is what this apparatus does, and this is the interest it guards, right? Same thing in America. Like, you guys have MI6, it's a school of City of London bankers. We have Wall Street lawyers that made OSS and CIA. So you got bankers and lawyers working together in this transatlantic operation. And the history of espionage that America had was like zero. We had zero experience. So when Frank Wisner and these other guys from OSS start hanging out with their British counterparts, like, they start kicking off a whole bunch of operations. I mean, the only reason we have a problem with Iran today, if you want to trace it back, is Operation Ajax in 1953. Most people blame it on CIA, but I want to note, CIA was new back then. We had our experienced cousins from MI6 leading the operation. Why? Because it's British petroleum. That's what Iranian oil has been. That's the history of it. I mean, let me just type in... BP, because Americans, we get gas, we get petrol at BP all the time. British Petroleum comes from the Anglo-Iranian oil company, and that can go back up into Burma oil and the British syndicate and the Rothschilds that formed from that. And you can find this out in How Big Oil Conquered the World by James Corbett. You can learn all these things. Look at this. All these things are in that one little documentary. Well, so lots to learn.
So you mentioned earlier that you worked on Wall Street.
I sold software to banks and insurance companies.
Right.
Okay. So technically, I had offices on Madison Avenue. I had an office in the Helmsley Building, which is a beautiful building that it's the one right in front of the MetLife Building that goes on Park Avenue. They show it in all the movies. So I had offices in those places. My office in the World Trade Center was because I had a client there, and we had so many people working on that project, and we spent so much time there that we got cubicles, and I got an office to share with the consultant who we hired. So
Wall Street area, when it accidentally collapsed.
I was driving as fast as my Porsche would go in New Jersey away from the scene, because I left ground zero when World Trade Center 2 exploded. And so I thought it was an accident up to that point.
So you were in the building when it got hit?
No, I was in my car headed to the building. I was headed to the 98th floor to deliver some paperwork. And so I wasn't working at the time. I wasn't concerned with being on time. I was going to the beach later that day, and I might have taken my time on my way there. It was a beautiful morning. There was like not a cloud in the sky. I had the top down, and I did not hear a plane fly over and hit the building. I was close enough where I think I would have heard it, but when I saw the building, it was just pouring out smoke.
So where are you on that one? Do you think it was holograms, or do you think it was it wired for demolition by the Israelis?
Well, that, sir, is a very insightful question that I will seek to answer to your satisfaction. So here's how I treat it. Since I didn't see it, I have to look at the evidence of it. There's no evidence of what happens at the North Tower until the day after the event. It comes to the public. So in other words, on the day of 9/11, when Piers Morgan said he saw both planes hit the building, that's not true, because the first plane hitting the North Tower, that footage is not shown until the next day. It's filmed by the Naudé brothers, a French brother team of film guys that were filming with the New York Fire Department. And they later did the authoritative documentary for the CIA featuring 12 living CIA directors. So I'm telling you about the provenance and the origin of the footage that people want to say Flight 11 hit North Tower. That's how it starts. My question would be, how did you identify that that's Flight 11? By what means did you come to that conclusion? Did you track a transponder? Do you have serial numbers? Did someone visually read a tail number at a plane at 1,000 feet going allegedly 500 miles an hour that can't be replicated in a simulator? By the way, airframes, terminal air velocity at that altitude is not that. So like when you get into the pilots and the black boxes and the evidence of the thing, there's a lot of questions raised. The transponders turn off. There's two hijacked flights in the morning of 9/11. Transponders turn off, and then they turn back on. And right here is Stewart Air Force Base in New York, notorious for drug importation by the military. Right. Ecstasy and other things that a mafia might participate in. A mafia that might control such properties. So you have a lot of overlaps of mafioso types with large insurance policies and asbestos problems. And all of a sudden you got this national security thing where there's 47 drills that morning, confusing the shit out of everybody. And I can't figure out how the guys with the box cutters did all this stuff, by the way. I can't figure out how the specific insider trading of United Airlines and Martian McLennan, my client, which allegedly met up on the morning of 9/11, that's the North Tower event. So I have a lot of questions about such things. Let me posit this. If our government has remote controlled planes run by Dov Zakheim, who's also like the guy who's responsible for the missing trillions at the Pentagon, if we have remote controlled planes down in Florida at this Air Force base, might be MacDill, And they look almost identical to the things you're seeing in those videos. And the transponders go off and we don't have serial numbers and we don't have these other things that would correspond to aviation crashes. Like, what is Flight 93 in Pennsylvania? If you look at pictures of that place before the plane crash, there's just an irrigation ditch. And if you look at it after the plane crash, there's an irrigation ditch on fire. So I don't know why the parts from Flight 93 are spread out over 8 miles if it crashed into the ground. So I'm confused about some of these things. And maybe it's just because I went through an American school system and I'm not that smart, but I keep finding inconvenient pieces of evidence that are outside the official narrative. And I could probably cite 30 or 40 colleagues who were murdered that morning. Their families were lied to. And I, along with a lot of other Americans, still have a lot of questions and very few answers from my government.
Right. So, do you know what? I've never done a full podcast on 9/11 just because I think, well, obviously it was an inside job, and what more could I discover that I kind of haven't inferred already and stuff. But actually, there is so much that makes me curious. Like, for example, so you know, 40 families of people who got, how did they die? Were the towers vaporized in that kind of explosion, do you think?
Well, that's interesting, because if you watch the deverticalization of the South Tower first, and then the North Tower, and then World Trade Center 7 later, you'll notice there are two different phenomenon. The towers match, and the World Trade Center 7 just looks like a controlled demolition.
Yeah.
Where they take out something in the basement, and you can see the whole building crack, and then it falls into its own footprint.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I think the real estate developers who were responsible for removing the asbestos found it probably to be more expensive to do it legally than illegally. And so you got money, you got all sorts of other motives involved. And if they join up with somebody else who has motives and you say, hey, put anything in these buildings you want to get rid of. You want to put the Enron records in there. You want to put some inconvenient whistleblowers, people who notice too much, have them go to meetings that morning. I can cite about 5 or 6 other situations where people were called into the buildings that morning. Some of those people aren't here anymore, like Barry Jennings. Someone told that guy, go to the 23rd floor, World Trade Center 7. He gets there. The place is like empty, ghost town. Who put him in there? Who put Giuliani's lawyer in there, Michael Hess? Did Hess call, you know, like these questions have
so
yet
it's
to
like
be answered?
The Titanic, yeah, where JP Morgan gets all his rivals
on there, and then he splits. He gets off at the first stop. You're right. You're absolutely right. There's an Astor that dies on the Titanic as well, and he might have opposed the Federal Reserve Act, for instance.
Yeah.
So William T. Stead might have disagreed with this conspiracy as he saw it unfolding in the first several years of the 20th century. Put him on the boat. I'm not saying that's happened, because I don't like to, like, I like everything I say to be like, here's the fact and go learn about it. But sometimes you have to say, if there's a piece missing, what would go here, right? That's the origin of conspiracy theory in the beginning. National security censors things. They take a piece out of the puzzle and everyone's like, which piece goes in there? We know what these pieces look like. What goes in here? What fits, right? It's a process of reasoning and adjudication by trial and error sometimes, but it is a very necessary process for understanding how the world works and what goes on, because you're never going to have all the pieces. You can't expect to have all the pieces. These people are pretty good at what they do.
Okay. So who was the guy you mentioned, Barry Jennings, that got?
Barry Jennings was one of the town managers for New York City. So he had a very high up position in the New York City government, and the 23rd floor of World Trade Center 7 was Rudy Giuliani's Emergency Operations Center. It's like an EOC. Interestingly enough, it was recommended to put that center in Brooklyn because the trade centers might be a target of terrorism. But they chose to put it in World Trade Center 7. And then on the morning of, when they do have an emergency, they didn't use it. Do you want to know why, James?
Why is that?
Because they were running drills that morning I think it's Operation Tripod.
Oh, here you go. Mean that
so Giuliani has a mock operation center already set up down by the river. And so there's all these different war games going on that morning that other government people are already participating in. And the authoritative book on such things is Synthetic Terror by Webster Tarpley, who's a Fulbright scholar and also lectures quite vociferously on the Venetian black nobility and Lord Palmerston's zoo. That's one of his famous lectures. Anyway, it's fascinating and interesting.
Isn't it a stroke of luck that they all happen to be on a rehearsal for another operation? Because what are the chances?
Actually, what are the chances that MI6 could warn the CIA so many times? What are the chances that they had an aircraft exercise where they crashed a plane into the Pentagon? Like, these were exercises that they practiced before 9/11. I have the reports and,
they took
and the
out
artifacts.
An inconvenient part of the Pentagon, didn't they? What was the bit that got destroyed?
Okay, so the part of the Pentagon that gets hit, or let me put it this way, because me saying hit assumes a bunch of things.
Yeah.
The part of the Pentagon that exploded,
yeah,
was a recently reconstructed with reinforced bomb-proof glass area of the Pentagon that housed civilian accountants from various units and also housed Office of Naval Intelligence activities. And the Pentagon is only like 50 feet high. Okay. It's not a very tall building. So to get a plane that low to the ground, planes land they get sucked to the ground. They lose lift that close to the ground. They cannot do so there's that. But let's pretend I'm wrong on that. Let's just look at the building. The building has fires in the first couple minutes of this event. And these are the most important photos. You can see continuity of windows, and there's no room for plane to go in to where there's continuity in the structure. Okay. So what you see is you see fires at the Pentagon, and then there is an event. And James, this event is a very specific event because it slices the Pentagon like I took a knife and just cut it like I'm cutting cake. Okay. Now the Pentagon seems to have crushed in this area, and there's some floors over here. Okay. I challenge anyone in the audience, find a still of that video and zoom in. You will see like a dictionary on a stool open. Its pages are fine. It has not been on fire. You see a straight cut through the wall, like somebody put charges or demolition in the wall and just cut it away. This is not a function of structural failure from the plane entering and taking out columns. It would not happen so symmetrically, so perfectly, so precisely without charring and making everything on fire.
Sorry to interrupt you, Richard. And please. I don't think anyone watching this is thinking, oh, maybe it was a plane that crashed in that funny way on the Pentagon. I'm just curious as to which departments did they destroy and why? Who did they kill? Well, what inconvenient people were bumped off?
September 10th, 2001, Rumsfeld announced that the Pentagon was missing $2.3 trillion that it could not track. Right. So the Pentagon announces, now usually, first off, is $2.3 trillion a lot? Back then it was. That was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
You give bad news on Friday press conferences so that people forget it over the weekend. You don't do it on Monday unless you know something's happening Tuesday. It's going to wipe away everyone's Monday memory. Okay. So when I pointed this out in 2006 in my first publication called Project Constellation, I mentioned a bunch of stuff in there that's going on today, like Larry Ellison and these sort of things. But the $2.3 trillion I pointed out, and there's a Pittsburgh Press article from November of 2001 by a guy named Milan Simovic, Milan Simovic. You'll have to find it on Wayback Machine, but it's Army Unit Pieces Together Pentagon. And in the second or third paragraph, it talks about the civilian bookkeepers and accountants who were in that area who were exposed to the explosion and perished. But also, Office of Naval Intelligence is the oldest intelligence agency in America. And so for it to be disabled during the attack, I don't know that they were just looking for new offices or renovations. They might have been a target as well. They might have been somebody who could have pushed back, provided resistance. I don't know. But the people that were in that area, many of them perished instantly. And then people who were at their desks and were able to survive the explosion, I've seen some of their testimonies and what they've discussed there. I don't recall them saying, we heard the plane coming in, it got really loud, and then there was a crash. Like, I don't remember that from,
I'm not really interested in the mechanism of the fakery, or because how would you know? But I am interested in the same way that the Enron papers were stored in Building 7.
Yeah,
I'm just curious about which, because there's a possibility, isn't there? You just raised it, that maybe that Naval Intelligence Department had integrity. I don't know. I mean, maybe they were not considered sufficiently on board with the deep state program. Is that likely, though?
Yeah, I could see that as a potential, because if you look back at the Kennedy assassination, my hypothesis would be that Lee Harvey Oswald was undercover for Office of Naval Intelligence, who had sniffed out that these Nazi financiers and the people that brought the Nazis here through CIA Operation Paperclip were planning an executive action, citing Operation 40 and Operation Mongoose. You got this group of Nazis. Now they have professional assassins, and this other guy, they don't like him too much, none. So if Office of Naval Intelligence puts a guy out there like Oswald and gives him a cover story that he went to Russia and came back and he's okay to work with David Ferry. Who's David Ferry? These guys are all working in the Civil Air Patrol, which was smuggling drugs. This is also why George W. Bush, a pilot, went MIA. He went AWOL with James R. Bath, the bin Laden banking guy. They go AWOL together while they're flying around. So I've seen that as a continuity of like drug money, cartel type stuff, and then rich people's kids who are involved in it also participating. So I'm not saying like George W. Bush is like running the thing. I'm saying since his family does that, he knows he can get on a plane with Bath, go get whatever, wherever, and sell it back into the system, because the guy he's flying with is the Saudi bin Laden. It's Salim bin Laden's banking guy, James R. Bath, which is the whole kit and caboodle. If you understand what happened behind 9/11, you've got people who funded the Nazis, who then get blackmailed for funding Nazis. And then you've got a deep capture of America. And on our side of that deep capture, you got the people who got away with funding the Nazis, killing Kennedy, and getting blackmailed out of our country's foreign policy.
Yeah, the Bush family, they punch above their weight in terms of of evil.
Okay, but why? Because they have the 1832 Skull and Bones East India Company Yale connection, that opium connection. That's where Prescott Bush got close to the Harrimans. The Harrimans were some of the biggest tycoons and railroad builders. They helped to provide infrastructure for what became Soviet Russia and Communist China. This is through the American International Corporation. It's the first chapter of Sutton's Wall Street and Bolshevik
Revolution.
This
is why
maybe
you want to get admitted to Skull and Bones, because you get to hang with these people and you're made, aren't you, for life?
Well, for them, it's the approval process. Right. So if you go through a pledge ship at Skull and Bones and you can keep their secrets, then you are prime material to be recruited back in the day for CIA. That's like where George Herbert Walker Bush doesn't officially work for the CIA because he comes from the ruling class that created the CIA, and which is why he's later a director of the CIA. And he likely was involved on November 22nd, 1963. But there's another November 22nd that came in 1947 that is very illustrative of maybe the executive action that came on the other same date. November 22nd, 1947, Nelson Rockefeller got blackmailed, not for the first time. The blackmail, are you familiar with this story? Or the
the Rockefeller brothers.
All right, I'll tell you the story, and then I'll tell you the proof of the story behind the story, right? The Rockefellers in the 1930s have Rockefeller Center, which is like the home of NBC. And it's, you know, it's a famous TV studio today. Back then, it's Rockefeller Center is the home of their empire. They rent out floors of their empire to British Security Coordination and Sir William Stevenson, who works with R. William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, and British Security Coordination starts running spies in the United States, spies like Roald Dahl and David Ogilvy and Ian Fleming and a whole bunch of other people. It's very interesting, but I'm going to fast forward you now to the later history of that same building. So they've already worked with the British to bring intelligence into America and create the CIA and all these things that follow. By the time you get to 1947, which, by the way, they just created the CIA a couple months ago. This is November 22nd, 1947. Nelson Rockefeller is in his office. These two dudes go up in the elevator. They have a meeting with him. So they walk in, they sit down, they throw this file on the desk. He opens it up. It's a bunch of Nazi stuff, proving he's funding Nazis. Yeah. And he's like, what does Ben-Gurion want to keep this quiet? Well, Nelson Rockefeller has sway over some Latin American votes at this new organization that his family just donated the land and built the building for, called the United Nations. And this group wants his votes to go for approval so they can get unanimous consent or enough consent for the creation of the state of Israel. So they're there to blackmail Nelson Rockefeller to give votes that he personally doesn't have, but he controls. It's a voting block. So they're blackmailing him, and he sits back, he closes the file, he takes a drink. Now, I was like, how do they have these details? Well, I'm going to tell you about the source for the story in a second. So Nelson says, you tell Ben-Gurion he can have his blood or he can have his land. He can't have both. Point number one, no one ever sees this file. Point number two, the real bankers never go on trial. You can't have your land and your blood. So the real bankers that did the Nazi thing, they're never going to see trial. Okay. And you take that back to them. So now they're all crestfallen. They went in there like, we're going to blackmail Nelson Rockefeller. And then they found out he's really good at blackmail and he had some moves of his own. So now they wait like 5 hours. Ben-Gurion calls back and agrees to the terms. And then following that, the next chapter is they get their votes. Now, that comes from a novel written by a Canadian novelist called Brendan Howley and an American researcher called John Loftus. Now, I've interviewed John Loftus before. He's a fascinating character. He was a Nazi hunter for the United States Department of Justice. He's a lawyer. He's a lawyer for intelligence agency whistleblowers. He himself was on a famous episode of 60 Minutes in the early 1980s. And he's like, Mike so-and-so got the Emmy and my family got death threats. So here's a guy who's walked the walk, who saw some things. So he had a cosmic NATO clearance. And he went into the Suitlands, Maryland, underground 24-acre vaults of national security stuff that no one's seen since, you know, they invented the idea of God in there. And he's got these access to NATO and Brussels and France and all these different places with his intelligence clearance because he's hunting Nazis. And he starts finding out who brought the Nazis to America, that one of his friends, Saul, who's a Holocaust survivor, lives in a town right next to the Nazi who prosecuted him because the CIA brought him. So he's discovering all this stuff. He wrote these books. He wrote books like The Secret War Against the Jews, America's Nazi Secret. There's a whole coterie of books. So I did an extended interview with him about 10 years ago. And so I asked him, I'm like, so, you know, tell me about this claim that is in this book called The Witness Tree. And he's like, well, didn't you read the appendix or whatever? So I looked in the appendix of the book, and this is more fascinating than the story itself. The guy who tells the story, his name is Reuven, R-E-U-V-E-N, Shiloah, S-H-I-L-O-A-H. Do you know who he is? Ever heard his name?
Nope.
He created a little intelligence agency called Mossad. The Mossad. Yeah. So the story comes from the guy who founded the Mossad and ran the operation and sent his guys, Elam and whatever the other guy's name was, to blackmail Nelson Rockefeller. And he got a meeting. He called John Loftus and said, you know, there's this part that, you know, I don't know if he was correcting his research or whatever, but that's the source. So now you could say, hey, Reuven Shalhoub, he wages war by deception. That's the motto of Mossad. Maybe he's lying. Yeah, maybe. Maybe. But let me ask you this question. If Nelson Rockefeller was blackmailed in 1947 and that blackmail didn't go away because he always funded the Nazis and they could blackmail him up to his death where he died with his head between his secretary's legs. Okay. Young age. David Rockefeller lived to like almost 100. Nelson died very early after he was governor and ran for president. And he was actually, I think, vice president at one point with Ford.
He was.
After they took out Nixon during Watergate. It's very interesting history these guys have when you get into the details. You know, it's a lot more interesting than what they tell you on the History Channel, for instance, or the Nightly News with Walter Cronkite. So when you get into that blackmail never went away and who killed Kennedy and what they had to lose, the people that, you know, so there's a chain of events that leads back to the people who kept getting away with the things and kept remaining in power. That's how you get two Bush presidents in this country. That's how you have a John Kerry skull and bones running for president, because the opium syndicate, like that thing's a thing. And the Afghanistan war we just fought for 20 years is the fourth Anglo-Afghan war, if you look at it, right? And where else were we? We were in Baghdad. Well, the opium warlord of Baghdad was David Sassoon, and he married into the Rothschild family. His progeny married into the Rothschilds in the 1880s. So again, you have the syndicates of warlords and gangsters and all these sort of things. Melded together outside the official story. The Saudi bin Laden group, bin Laden's construction company, had input on the World Trade Center architecture because there's an artist whistleblower called Paul Loffoli who was in the office when their people came to see Leslie Robinson when they're designing the building. So I just find it hard to believe that like 40 years later, the black sheep of the family comes back with his terrorist and takes the thing down that you can't. So let me just say this for anyone who's never looked at the situation. Watch the video of Tower 2 collapse. I started to say this earlier. Watch the video of Tower 1 collapse. Realize that's about 20 seconds total time. What you're seeing, because each floor is one square acre. I don't know how that translates in English. You guys use acres? That's where we got, right?
Yeah, we know acres.
We're on the same side then.
Yeah.
Each floor is an acre. Each tower is about 110 stories. 220 square acres. Of concrete reinforced with rebar, with huge, massive internal core structures, turns to dust and is distributed all over town, not because of gravity, not because of jet fuel, but because of people's ignorance and their willingness to listen to people with authority, tell them lies and say, oh, yes, please, more, give me slop. So that's why I push education as a solution, because the only reason they can do these things and ride roughshod over us is because they've dumbed everybody down and that human capacity has not been amputated or cauterized. As I used to say, I truly believe it can be dormant and then reinvigorated, revitalized with new facts in history, like William T. Stead and Cecil Rhodes and Moses Hess. And you bring these facts to the table, things get a lot more interesting. People get optimistic. Because we were only at a disadvantage when we didn't understand and couldn't have agency to bring about consequences that, you know, helped us achieve our desired results.
Richard, I feel like there's loads more podcasts that we have in us. You're an encyclopedia of.
Well, this is a fun workout to get started, James. I mean.
I think so. I think
I didn't even have coffee. I don't take any meetings before 11 a.m. Eastern time. So you truly got me today. Like I'm up and at 'em, but I don't know that I fully have recall and dexterity of all the facts I need to marshal.
You did a fine job.
Answers. Well, thank you.
You did a very fine job.
That means a lot
job.
Coming from you.
No, it's great chatting to you and meeting you. I mean, I always like to. Sometimes it feels, you must feel this, it feels quite lonely sometimes that like there's only a limited market for this stuff because most people are just so brainwashed by.
See, I don't take that as lonely. I just see it as like when you're an early adopter of something, a lot of people aren't, they're just not going to get the idea right away. And I'm okay with that. Like I started podcasting 20 years ago this next week. So my first publication was May 31st, 2006, but I didn't publish it. I had sent something confidential to somebody and they put it on the internet and then I got doxxed. So my first publication, my first podcast was July 22nd, 2006, on the anniversary, second anniversary of the 9/11 Commission report being released, because that's when I knew that the people that were responsible for finding the truth were not going to do that. Like, it was another Kennedy assassination cover up. And then I started researching more diligently. So when I first made a podcast, July 22nd, 2006, I was not only bringing people like, here's what you need to know, but I also taught them in the first episode how to podcast. I'm like, I just figured out how to do this thing. You can figure out how to do this thing too. And so I've always coupled my research of the problem with like enacting the solution. I also do this other thing that's unusual, I guess. I call it like third stage philanthropy. Like you could give when you die, or you could give after you make money. I like to give while I'm making money and do the thing so I can actually see the results real time. So I've always balanced like being an entrepreneur with doing good for people who show up in front of me, right? I work with the people the good Lord puts in front of me in life, and I do my best to help them with what they need as far as problem solving. Asymmetrical problem solving is probably the number one skill that people could own easily without a degree and be able to elevate their game and feel better and less lonely about this. When you're in process of enacting solutions, there's less time for, I feel lonely, or I feel like a victim, or I feel like we're, you know, all those negative things that kind of fester are driven out through positive actions. And so that also puts you around other people who are likewise invigorated getting into the solutions, right? So I know there's a lot of people out there, they can feel cut off and you don't have people to talk to about this, but you also have to recognize there are small groups of people doing something and talking about it. Like, a lot of people have podcasts. I've always had a community with my podcast, so you can have additional interactivity. And that's really like the thing that helps people. For instance, my Grand Theft World podcast right now that I've been doing, every 2 weeks we have a town hall. So people who are members, they come, we do a Zoom call, we all talk to each other. It's like a normal conversation. And that is such a breath of fresh air, and that kind of depressurizing and taking the piss out of their fear every couple of weeks keeps everybody calm, cool, collected. And like, what do we got to do next? You know, what's the problems in front of us, and how do we have thoughtful responses instead of the reactions that enslave us? The assumptions and the reactions are basically how, like, they have MK Ultra, yes, but they don't need it as long as people assume and react. And so once we as humans can say, I have responsibility in this, if I say it's Bill Gates doing the thing, I have to wait for Bill Gates to fix it. So F Bill Gates, I'm going to take responsibility for my life. I'm going to write my own script in life. I'm going to see a positive way to get through this timeline, because I only have one life to live. And just because these people want to like have COVID doesn't mean I have to put my life on hold. I made a decision when they did that. I'm just going to go bigger. I'm not going to wilt and like hide from this thing. I need to go figure out who did it, how they did it, how to protect ourselves, and how to thrive despite them doing these things, because I don't like to give these pricks the satisfaction. That's a line from Heartbreak Ridge. I stole it from Clint Eastwood.
Did you? Yeah, well, that's good. I admire your attitude, Richard. Please definitely come back on the podcast again. Do you need to tell us anything about, I mean, you've got the website address of grandtheftworld.com. Is that the best place to find you?
The gist is this. I have 168 hours every week. It is the place we are all equal. We get the same amount of time. So I split my time between serving people and solving high value problems. And I teach adults the things we didn't learn in school. And I teach that at getautonomy.info. I've been doing that. I created the University of Reason. The flagship course is called Autonomy. It's a 12-week course to replace and repair the education so we can survive and thrive in the world. I've had 1,000 students plus go through there over the past 7 years. And there's summer school going on right now. The Grand Theft World podcast is my hobby. I do it Sunday nights from 9 p.m. until 5 a.m., 4 a.m. Eastern time. We analyze the news of the week, but we also juxtapose it to the historical artifacts and evidence. The idea is Grand Theft World allows you to understand watching Twitter or mainstream news just fragments your understanding. You don't have a chance to get an understanding. So we do that as like a public service, helping people to have a coherent, non-contradictory understanding of what's going on. And that gives them the confidence to excel at all the other things, family, friends, professional stuff during the week. Thank you so much, James, for having me on. This is a lot, of fun. Good workout.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And look, see you again very soon. And everyone, thanks for watching and thanks for supporting me. And please, those of you who don't yet, do consider doing so. Thanks a lot, Richard.
Thank you, James.
There is now a new, better way of supporting me. If you want to, you can now subscribe direct at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. It's now got new features where you can subscribe directly to me. You get access to all my old archive material. You get my podcasts as they come out. And you can comment on the podcasts and you can communicate with me probably more directly than you can elsewhere. I think it's probably the best way forward. Also, it obviates the risk of my being suddenly randomly closed down by some of these other websites. I mean, they're not our friends. So if you want to support me direct, go to jamesdellingpole.co.uk and sign up there. Without your support, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So thank you.
Support ridiculously honest, no holds barred, independent truth seeking at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. The Delling Pod is produced by Wolfish Limited. Guests are very kindly booked by the lovely Venetia. The show is edited by Andrew Warwick, with animation by Warwick A.